giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing In to Other Giant Robots podcast. It is Friday, March 8th. My name is Ben Orenstein. I'm here today with Avdi Grimm. Hey, Avdi.
Hello from Pennsylvania.
How's it going?
It's going great.
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you're an Emacs user.
I am.
Yeah.
One of those.
You might be one of the first Emacs users we had on the podcast. Are you worried about that fact?
I think the Church of Emacs is pretty secure in its eventual dominance of all life.
Yeah. I actually, this might shock some people, but I've actually spent a lot of time using Emacs.
Have you?
I went through a Common Lisp period, as one does in their adolescence. And
as one does.
Before they graduate to real editors, I used Emacs for a while. And I will admit, being able to program your editor in Lisp is pretty damn amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So I can't fault you for that. I think Emacs users like typing.
I'm in good company. I mean, Jim Wyrick uses Emacs.
That's true. And he's on the cutting edge. So. Yeah. I also noticed I was stalking you on Twitter in preparation for this podcast. I noticed that you have an online assistant.
Yeah, I do have an assistant.
Yeah. And you were like sending her tasks via Twitter, which blew my mind a little bit.
I don't usually do that, but in that case, it was just convenient because it was like, hey, I can just CC everybody concerned. And
So how is that working out? Is that a worthwhile expense?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. A lot of the stuff that I do just wouldn't be possible without Mandy.
Hmm.
I've been working with her for, I think, over a year now.
Huh.
I'd have to check that, but it's been a while now, and it's been fantastic.
I don't think I've ever met someone that was like, oh, I started outsourcing all these tasks that I don't really want to do, and I hate it. Everyone's always like, this was the best thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how deep you want to get into that, but...
So deep.
I highly recommend it. I mean, it depends on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
If your whole day just consists of writing code, there probably aren't a lot of things that you could delegate to an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you start getting into, you know, having a lot of different demands on your time, different people asking for appointments and stuff like that, or if you have some side projects that involve something other than coding, which for me include
so many things.
Well, yeah, a number of things, including like a podcast.
Yeah,
the Wide Teams podcast, mm-hmm. and so I initially started looking for an assistant when scheduling got kind of nuts. I was consulting, and I had started doing some pair programming sessions, and I tried all of the online scheduling tools.
Mm-hmm.
And they all sucked in their own special ways. And the bottom line, I think it's an intractable problem as far as software goes until we have real AIs, because nothing can beat having a human touch when it comes to scheduling, because, you know, they can understand your schedule and understand how you're, you know, what a particular week is like. You know, they can get a feel for, whether a week is particularly heavy or there's some, you know, family obligation that makes a week a bad time to schedule a bunch of stuff.
Mm.
And there's just so many little rules that, you know, I wanted to encode into scheduling tools and I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And even just like leave out all the rules stuff, the fact, you know, if a scheduling goes bad, there's a conflict at the last minute or something, a human can sort that out a lot more gently and, a lot more happily than trying to deal with some robot. So,
totally.
In so many ways, that was an improvement. But then, you know, we started expanding out, and I started having her do some stuff with the podcast. And at this point, literally all I do is show up for the interviews.
Perfect. That's kind of what I get too.
She schedules them, edits them, writes up the show notes, writes up the summaries, posts them.
Yep. That's Chad Pytel does pretty much all that for us, except like the recording and editing, which are other people. Mm-hmm. But it's they let me just be the talent, and fortunately I only get involved at record time.
And now she's also the one who takes care of the Ruby Rogues podcast and the other Chuck's other podcasts. So
Yeah, so we sort of dove in here, but I didn't really give you an intro. So we should talk about you because you're a guy and you do stuff.
That's a pretty good summary.
Yeah, and it seems to be a lot of Ruby stuff. I mean, I have notes on you, and my notes are huge because you do so many things.
Is this the part where you lay the folder down and say, we have a file on you?
We've been watching you for some time, Mr. Grimm. Yeah, so you're an author. You've got some books that are highly regarded by some of my coworkers and even other humans.
Yay.
Yeah. You're a podcaster. You're a mailing list contributor. You're a screencaster. You're a parer. You're a blogger. So when are you going to just give all this up and get a real job?
Hopefully never.
Is that the plan? You're liking how things are going?
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a steady progression, career wise towards, you know, better control of my own schedule and that sort of thing.
Yeah. It seems like you have all these like sort of, mini businesses here and there that sort of combine to make up an income in a week and whatnot.
A giant robot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although actually, so my job right now is Ruby Tapas.
Right.
For a while, this year it was consulting pair programmer.
Uh-huh.
Or actually I should say last year, maybe about half, a little over half the year. My job description was consulting pair programmer. I went from doing that a little bit to doing no regular consulting work and doing nothing but pairing sessions. In the last month, I've started transitioning over to being, you know, full time on Ruby Tapas and tailing off the pairing sessions because it was just getting to be a bit too much.
Right. I liked your, so I read your post about, winding down the pairing, and there's an awesome quote that I want to read real quick, which is, someone had asked you one of the most common things that you help people with in these sessions. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was great. So you said, I think the most common problem I help people with is naming things. So often they'll present me with some code that they don't feel good about, and I'll ask them questions about it until some domain concept emerges that had been lying implicit in the logic, but that they hadn't yet addressed by name. We'll name it, make it into a method or class, and they'll say something like, wow, that helps me understand my own code better. And that's awesome. Like I talk about this in some of my talks, which is every time I can pull an implicit concept out of the code and make it explicit and give it a name and point to it and call it something, it makes things so much better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things to hear is at the end of a session is I understand my own code better now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's surprising how much clarity that gives you. And it's because it's so easy for things to show up implicitly in code. Like they kind of sneak in there. And all of a sudden, there's all this stuff that has to do with like user registration or something, but you've never created a user register.
Right.
Registerer.
Registerer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually something I've been thinking about a lot lately is that is the idea of encoding processes as objects in their own right.
Hmm.
We talk about this a fair amount, and you know, one of the things that you run across or that I run across in code bases more and more are things called like, you know, user registerer, although I think I would have to insist on calling that user registrar.
Mm.
So that might not be as good an example of what I'm talking about, but a lot of times you find a name that ends in er.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, I don't think that's inherently a bad thing. Some folks have taken to calling objects like that service objects, which I think is a completely meaningless term. But I think that sometimes that terminology it's one of those naming concerns that can lead you a little bit astray. Because sometimes what I find are objects named, you know, like user adder, let's say.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's an object which is supposed to encapsulate the complex process of adding a new user.
Okay.
And sometimes I'll find that it's that because of the naming, because it's thought of as a thing that does this, you wind up with like one method on it,
which is like go.
It just reiterates the name of the class, user adder add user.
Mm-hmm.
Which is I think kind of an indicator right there. It's kind of a flag. Like if the name of the method is just reiterating the name of the class, you know, all you've done is you've is you've taken a method and made a class of it, which is can really be the start of some great refactoring. So
totally.
It's not a terrible thing.
It's method object.
But what I often see is that so they yeah exactly it's method object. But what they don't do in the method object progression is they don't actually convert it into an object representing a process. So what they do is they keep all of the parameters on like that add user method. And then, and then either they're just calling, user adder dot add user, blah with lots of params everywhere, mm-hmm. or maybe they just make it a class method and say, user adder dot add user.
Mm-hmm.
What I've found is that often when you rethink something like that, as an object actually representing the process, not an object representing a thing that does the process, but an object representing the process itself. So we might call it user addition. This is a user addition process, as in we processed 15 user additions this morning.
Mm-hmm.
It starts being a lot easier to do things like break the process down into multiple steps. It might turn out that a user addition actually has some discrete states that it needs to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes, I think, just thinking through it becomes easier. You start to pull those states out as maybe separate methods on the object. You may turn it into a state machine. You may actually discover that it makes sense to start saving them to the database. And so you make it an active record object or something like that, and you save that state. And so now you can have, a user addition process, and you can go and look at all the user additions which are currently in the, awaiting confirmation state or something like that. And that's kind of an evolution that I often see process objects go through, is that first it's just basically like an encapsulation of a method, bang, do it. But you gradually start wanting to have like more of a workflow, and then you start wanting to save that workflow midpoint at some intermediate state. And if the object actually represents the process rather than a thing that does that process, I think it can help you think about it can help you move in that direction.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't tried that, but now I want to apply this to some real code and see what that feels like. Is this something? Go ahead.
It's one of those things that it seems like a pointless quibble. Like, so we name it something slightly different. What's the big deal? But I have seen, like we were talking about earlier, I've seen it happen over and over and over again that we pull out a term like that, and suddenly everything kind of falls into place, and we're no longer, the thing is when you're thinking of in terms of like a user adder, you start doing stuff like, oh, we need to save the intermediate state of this, and now we need some other object to represent the state, the state of it, or some hunk of data to as a token to represent the state of it. And but if you think of it as a user addition, then it naturally becomes, oh, well, that's a state, a piece of state on the user, this particular instance of user addition.
Right. I'm also picturing like the public API getting better for this. So like if you have user adder dot add, that's sort of like you said, that's kind of maybe a little bit smelly with a duplicated name there, or just a reiteration of name. But if it's sort of adding user process, it's like your first method is like something like begin, or like whatever the real first step of this addition actually is. And like subsequent method calls are other well-named steps.
Right. Right.
So tell me about object on Rails.
What can I tell you about objects on Rails?
It's in progress, right? It's still going?
Oh, no. That's done? That's long finished.
Okay.
I'm working on Confident Ruby right now.
Gotcha. So you have Objects on Rails, Exceptional Ruby, and Confident Ruby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your favorite of your children? Which one do you love the most?
I think I'm already happiest with Confident Ruby.
Hmm.
I think Confident Ruby sums up so many of the things that I have wanted to sort of get out into the world. And it's given me the opportunity to investigate some things that I never had time to fully investigate before. It's obviously it's still an alpha. It's nowhere near complete, but it already has, in my opinion, some of the most complete coverage of conversions in Ruby that you'll find anywhere.
Conversions.
So implicit conversions, explicit conversions, you know, you things like 2A versus 2ary.
Okay.
When to use one, when to use the other. Mm-hmm. Then the conversion functions, as they're sometimes referred to, which are capital named methods,
mm-hmm.
Which usually provide sort of a generic, a more generic form of conversion. So like there's a method named array, and it's actually named exactly the same as the class array,
mm-hmm.
But it's available anywhere. And it's sort of the magic arrayification operator. You can apply the array method to pretty much anything, and you will always get an array back.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll usually make sense the way it came back. Mm. So, you know, you give it an array, and you'll get the same array back. Give it a some singular object, you'll get an array wrapping that singular object. Give it a range, and you'll get the range broken out into an array, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So that's a big piece of the book?
Covered? It's just... it's just an example of something that I got to dig into as a result of working on this book.
Gotcha. Those are all self-published?
Yeah, yeah. I do have Exceptional Ruby. I have a distribution deal with the Prags, so mm-hmm. you can actually go to the Pragmatic Programmer and buy a copy there, although I get more money if you buy it straight from me. Mm-hmm. However, that is the one place that you can get a paper copy of Exceptional Ruby, so that's kind of nice.
Have you been happy with that arrangement with them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's been fantastic because, you know, they have a really big distribution network.
Sure. They've been around a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you are also a podcaster extraordinaire. I was looking at Ruby Rogues has just hit 95 episodes.
I know, right?
You guys started back in May of 2011.
Well, and I wasn't around back then.
Okay. When did you join?
I'd actually have to look at the episode list to figure out exactly when I joined.
Roughly.
I feel like that's been around a year, too.
Mm-hmm. How did you get hooked up with those guys?
I think some of them had seen Exceptional Ruby.
Mm.
And maybe some other stuff that they'd seen, maybe some of my blog posts or something. And they brought me on for... like a last minute guest spot.
Mm.
And then they did that again a couple of weeks later. And then, Aaron Patterson found that who was one of the panelists found that he just didn't have time for the show anymore. And they were looking for a replacement, and they asked me to fill in. So
with a nice
big shoes to fill
with a pleasing baritone voice,
I guess.
Gotta have the right radio voice to podcast.
Yeah.
And you also you run your own podcast, Wide Teams.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is you're chatting with sort of remote workers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the idea?
Yep, it's all about remote work.
Yeah. So you must be excited for 37 Signals' new book.
You know, I actually just heard somebody mention that in an interview. I didn't know anything about it. And then the last Wide Teams interview I did, they mentioned something offhand. Now I have to go look that up.
Gotcha. You don't have the right Google alerts going on.
Apparently not. Actually, you know, I do, but I just haven't. I paid any attention to them for a while.
Is your email a disaster area?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. I've been using the Gmail priority inbox, and that's been helping a lot.
Yeah.
I use a few tools to cope with the influx, but I still wind up falling several days to several weeks behind if I decide to focus on videos or a book or something for a while.
Right. Yeah. Do you wish you got less email?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, a lot of it I bring on myself by subscribing to mailing lists and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the rest of it, you know, is basically a good problem to have.
Right. That's exactly how I feel.
I get the nice... I tweet periodically things like, I get the nicest emails.
Mm.
And it's because I do.
Yeah. I get a few too many emails that don't matter to me, but I actually wish I got more emails that I did want to read.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I have an unlimited capacity for emails that are interesting new ideas or topics or people or things like that.
Just
bring it on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, I say this now, but we'll see. Speaking of email, you are also running the Ruby Rogues Parlee. Parlee? Parlee.
Mm-hmm. Parlee.
Parlee? That's not what Webster said.
Is it Parlee?
I thought it was Parlee too, but hey.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It's parlay.
I think a parlay is like where like you and I agreed not to go to war or something.
Well, okay. So there's that's actually parlay. That's the EY.
Okay.
It's yeah. Parlay is like when two opposing sides come out and meet on middle ground.
Yeah.
Without killing each other, and that is. That is what Ruby Rogue's parlay is. That's the what the naming is based on. Although it was initially spelled wrong, which confused. The AY is like when you parlay your success
into something,
basket weaving into a career with Martha Stewart or something. I don't know.
Speaking of conversion methods, basket weaving dot to career.
That's I'm totally biased, but that's like the best Ruby mailing list on Earth right now.
I believe it. So you guys have an interesting subscription structure on there, which is you can pay $10 once, you can pay $10 a month, or you can pay $50 a month. I think it is.
I think it might be $10 a year.
Oh, that's right.
It might be the low version. I'm not even.
What
sure.
did I say? Oh, once. Oh, yeah, $10 a year, $10 a month, or $50 a month, or something like that.
Yeah.
What is the approximate breakdown of people signing up for that?
Not a clue. I don't handle that part.
They just send you the checks?
Pretty much, yeah.
Nice. That's pretty awesome. Do you need anybody to send more checks to?
What's that?
I want more email or checks.
Do Monopoly checks count?
Whatever. So the mailing list, I'm actually not on it, but I've heard good things. I've heard people referencing it. You guys are getting some good discussion on there?
It's really fantastic. The signal to noise ratio is really low, and I think that was a big part of our thinking. I mean, yes, the subscriptions they give us some income from the podcast, which basically makes up for our time, and also for lets us do a bit more traveling and get a bit more getting out to conferences, and which was kind of one of the big ideas. But the other side of that is it turns out that putting a paywall in front of a mailing list keeps the signal to noise ratio really, really good.
Absolutely.
Because the people that are there want to be there.
Yep.
And they care about being there. And so it's not just, I'm going to hop on and ask a question I could have Googled and then hop back off.
Totally. Yeah. And, I think there's huge value in that. Are you familiar with Metafilter?
Yes.
Yeah. So they have the same model where it's you can comment after you pay them $5 once.
Okay, yeah.
And it's just like exactly that. It's a signal to noise filter. It just makes the quality better.
Yeah, and it works. Metafilter is great.
Yeah, it's
but yeah, we've had some long, long threads that have just been fantastic. It really reminds me of the early days of Ruby Talk, back a decade or so.
Very cool.
We invite all of the hosts, all the guests that we've had to join Parley. And a lot of them have. And so, it's great to have these conversations where, Jim Weirich chimes in and Noel Rappin chimes in and Glenn Vanderberg and on and on Gary Bernhardt and
totally any plans to eventually sort of free some of that content into some sort of package deal?
We've talked about it a bit. I mean, honestly, personally, I don't speak for the Rogues as a whole. I'd honestly love to see it just available, maybe just like without the ability to comment or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what we'll do with it, but yeah, I'd really love to see. I know that some of the members have actually started. I don't recall the name of this project, but they've actually started collecting some of the stuff together in kind of like digest form in like a GitHub project, I think.
That sounds useful.
Maybe I can find that if I can find that for you and send it to you for the show notes.
Yeah, that'd be great. So that'd be very cool.
So yeah, it's not really like I don't really want to hide information. I don't be like you can't have this information unless
totally.
It's more about supporting the show and keeping that signal to noise ratio high.
Yeah. Do you know about how many people are on the list these days?
Again,
No idea. Okay.
I don't have those stats.
Okay. So your focus these days is Ruby Tapas.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is a thrice weekly Ruby related screencasts.
Usually 5 minutes or less.
Uh-huh. I've seen actually a couple of the ones that you've released on your blog.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're good. 5 minutes is actually a really nice length. it's like I'm a little bit ADD with certain things, and mm-hmm. and it's just nice. It's like, okay, I know I can watch this because I know it's not going to be long. Like there's surprising value in that.
I'm glad to hear that, and I've heard that a lot. That was kind of, I mean, obviously I did not invent the Ruby screencast. Mm-hmm. A lot of people broke ground on that long before I did.
Sure.
The only thing that unique idea that I think I had was to keep them really short, to make it, you know, to focus really hard on introducing exactly one new concept per episode. And that was kind of a gamble. I really didn't know how people would respond to it. It seemed like a good idea.
Hmm.
It seemed like something that I would like, but, you know, I'm not necessarily representative. So it's been really nice to see that not only have people really liked the format, but I'm also starting to see some other folks starting projects that are similar for other languages. So that's exciting to me.
Yeah, it's impressive to me how into educational content the Ruby community is.
Yeah,
like, I'm not as familiar with other communities, of course, but like it seems to be just so strong. Like people willing to start these sort of projects, and other people willing to pay for that material. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. I feel like it creates such a strong community. Like there are so many ways to learn Ruby and learn Rails and things like that. There's just a lot of resources.
Yeah. I think that's one of the advantages in general of a open source language. I think I've seen that in plenty of other communities besides the Ruby one, but it's always around open source languages because, you know, when there's a corporate head of the technology, there's kind of a community expectation that the vast majority of the education is going to come from that corporate source. Whereas, you know, if it's an open source language with open source libraries, then everybody kind of knows that, you know, if you want to see it happen, then you have to make it happen.
Matt's is open source, so are we.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have any trouble keeping up with the schedule so far?
It's been tight sometimes. I mean, at this point, I've managed to get up to about a month of lead time.
Oh, nice.
But it's been tough, and mainly, you know, we discussed a little bit earlier that I've started tailing off on the pairing sessions.
Right.
And that's why, because it was doing, you know, as many as 20 pairing hours a week plus putting 3 or 4 episodes of Tapas together was getting kind of nuts.
Yeah, sounds like it. I interviewed Gary Bernhardt on the podcast a little while ago, and mm-hmm. he said that Destroy All Software had sort of started to feel like a job, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's better than a full-time job, but it's definitely like you have this deadline that you got to hit again and again. Are you experiencing some of that?
Yeah, well, I always kind of hoped that it would feel like a job, honestly. You know, I didn't really have any illusions about that, and like in launching it, it was always kind of a go big or go home venture. I knew that I wanted it. It was something I wanted to do, but it was also something that I wanted to be able to transition to, just as like, you know, how I wanted the direction I wanted my career to go. You know, just because I wanted to be running something myself, whether it was a software service or an educational service or something. Just, you know, it makes it easier to control my time and stuff like that. And so I kind of hoped that it would become a job. And so, yeah, I mean, there's that element of got to make the deadline. You know, every week I got to get out at least 3 videos to keep my keep that month lead time.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, at least I'm doing something that I love doing, which is, you know, I've been doing educational stuff long before it paid. I've been, you know, writing up stuff on my blog and whatnot for a long, long time. And the cool thing about this is that basically I get to write all the blog posts that I never had time for. Because I write everything first. I always write a script and then record. And so I'm basically writing 3 blog posts a week now, or 4 blog posts sometimes. And, you know, I can go through my backlog of stuff, cool stuff about Ruby that I always wanted to cover on the blog and never got to.
Nice. That's a good fit then.
Yeah.
So you got these projects going, and it sounds like a pretty interesting sort of day-to-day life. And it's working for you?
Yeah. I mean, especially once I get to the end of, like, the the pairing sessions that I still had, you know, I already had, I had like, it turned out I had like a, had them scheduled like a month out.
Yeah.
So, you know, I put that blog post up saying, okay, I'm taking down my shingle. I'm not going to take any new appointments for a while, but I'm still working through the backlog of appointments that I already had. I think once I get to the end of that, it's going to be a pretty good work-life balance.
Hmm. So how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10?
Yeah, 7-ish.
Yeah. That sounds pretty good.
I got room for progress.
Sure. I think that'll always be true. I bet no one ever hits 10.
I don't know.
You have to reach enlightenment or something.
Yeah. I don't know.
We're too good at adaptive hedonism.
Yeah, it's never quite good enough, is it?
Yeah, maybe not.
Stupid Joneses.
Yeah, exactly.
And their lawn and their TV.
Yeah, so I have an interview question for you, which is, okay, how do you want your life to look in 5 years?
Good question. How do I want my life to look in 5 years? Well, I hope that we're in a bigger house by then.
Hmm.
I know that's probably not the answer you're looking for.
That's relevant.
But apart from that, pretty much doing the same kind of thing that I'm doing now. I mean, spending time with the family, spending more time with the family. That's definitely a big part of it.
Hmm.
Nice house in the woods, you know, American dream.
Sure. Well, hey, it sounds like you're pretty close then. You just need the house mostly.
Yeah.
And a little more family time.
Yep.
Do you have any life missions that you want to knock out?
Life
or
missions.
Or keep making progress on?
I mean, my stretch goal, for a long time has been to create a global airship empire and usher in a new age of airship travel.
How's that going?
Still working on making that first billion, because that's kind of when I'll start making investments.
The first billion's the hardest.
That's what I hear.
Yeah. After that, it's all pretty easy.
That's why I called my company Shiprise. I like airships. I think it's the civilized way to travel. So,
huh. Interesting. Well, let's meet up on an airship sometime.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Do the
There's one that runs in. Let's see. Where are you located?
Boston.
Okay. Never mind. There's one that runs out of San Francisco.
Well, can we take one from Boston to San Francisco?
Not yet, and that's what I aim to fix.
Okay. Crossing the country should be via large inflated balloon-type transportation device.
I like things that are naturally buoyant rather than things that are, you know, naturally much, much heavier than the air around them and only kept aloft by great effort.
There is a certain amount of fail-safe in that. That should be kind of comforting.
It's like canoes, you know. A canoe, you can swamp it, still floats around.
Huh. I guess that is nice. So if people wanted to get in touch with you, what's a good way to do that?
Well, they can always go to my blog. I've got a contact form on there. Devblog.ovd.org has a contact form.
Okay. And I saw you saying that you do not want Twitter DMs.
No. No, I periodically... Somebody will DM me on Twitter and I'll discover it, you know, days later.
Yeah. I also find that when I get a new DM, Twitter wants to notify me on every device. Like it's marked as a new thing on every single place.
Oh, see, I have all notifications turned off at this point because it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so I don't get notified for it, and I might see it eventually on one of my Twitter clients.
Yeah.
And then like half the time that happens, it turns out that they don't follow me back.
Right.
Which means I can't DM them back.
Right.
It's just the worst form of communication possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't mind if people message me on Twitter, but man, if you want to actually have a conversation, send me an email.
Got it. Okay. So I think that actually wraps things up. But thanks very much for coming by and stopping in electronically.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So you don't want to talk about the law of Demeter at all?
Do you want to hit that? What do you tell give me your parting shot.
Actually, that would be a long parting shot. So
okay,
probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah, how did you told us we were wrong, and where did you say that, on the show notes or something? A comment
on the
blog?
Probably on the blog.
Okay,
yeah.
So if you,
I can't remember what you said, but the two big okay, I'll say it and you can edit it in if you want or not.
Sure.
But the two things that most people get wrong about the law of Demeter are that they think it's about the number of dots, which it isn't. They think it's about the number of it's really only one thing. It's basically people think that it's about the number of dots versus it's actually about the number of types you interact with.
So more dots are okay as long as I'm just manipulating the same type I keep getting back?
Yeah, like one of the objections that I'll see to the law of Demeter is, or Demeter, however the heck you pronounce it.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Is that, you know, if we respected Demeter all the time, we wouldn't even be able to do things like, you know, string dot downcase dot underscore dot strip dot whatever.
Yeah.
TRS. And that's totally not true because it's all about how many types you interact with, and each of those methods returns another string, which means that you are continually interacting with the same type. So everything's good. I mean, what you're not doing is you're not tying that method to a dozen different external types.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the APIs of those dozen different external types.
Right.
So
changes, you're not going to have changes that break that code unless you went through and started mucking with the string itself.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it's all about structural coupling, and it's all about structural coupling on the method to method level. It doesn't say anything. If you go and read the paper, it doesn't say anything about how many types your class can interact with.
Hmm.
It just says in a given method, try not to reach deeply into the structure of something else. You know, leave that to other methods so that at least, you know, that particular method only has like one or two things that can cause it, one or two reasons to change.
Hmm. You know, reading papers at the source, that's not really my style. I'm sort of more of a hearsay and, you know, this is what Joe told me to do.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like mostly what I do on my blog has been basically go read the source on something and then reiterate it. Like, I feel like a historian more than anybody that brings any kind of fresh ideas to the table. because there are so many memes out there that are like, you know, you hear... Somebody tells you the rule sometime and, you know, the rule don't have more than one dot in your method calls. You know, don't chain more than one dot in a method call, and that's the law of Demeter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they hear the rule and then they come across some perfectly valid reasons why it makes sense to chain some dots together, and then they're like, well, that's a stupid rule. Why was it ever called a rule in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it turns out that the paper says something totally other, but you know, memes spread, and they spread because they're simple.
Right. Exactly.
And
papers don't spread so well.
Right. Yeah. You know, but I still like rules. I like, we had a thread on Parley, where we were talking about rules, and Sandy Metz chimed in and said, you know, the thing about a rule is you can break it. I mean, rules exist to be broken. It's just that you have to convince your pairing partner that breaking it is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's for me what defines a rule. You know, you can have a guideline, but guidelines are something that it feels like you can break all the time. But rules are things that you have to go and convince somebody else why it's okay to break the rule. And that is the value of them, I think.
Mm. We take this approach too. So we have a style guide internally for the code, and we just say, you know, that the first thing it says in the style guide is follow the style guide unless you have a good reason not to.
Mm-hmm.
And like, then just make sure someone, you know, reviews it and says, yeah, that's, you're right. Do this instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's a pragmatic way of looking at things.
Explain it to somebody else and, you know, either it'll start to sound stupid or,
exactly.
Or they'll nod their head and say, yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah. That sounds good. All right. I'm going to let you go now.
All right.
Thanks for helping us smash all those giant robots. So if you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to thoughtbot.com/podcasts/39. Today's podcast was recorded by Anna Mariola, edited by Edward Lovell, and produced by Chad Pytel. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.